I get the pleasure of talking with our next speaker here. Let's welcome Banu with us here. Hi, Banu. How are you doing?
Hi, April. Very well, thank you. And thank you for having me here.
Awesome, great to be here. So you did an amazing talk on pioneering process improvement team at the ACT-W conference. So why don't you tell everyone first a little bit about yourself, your background, what you do, how you got started in tech, and then about your session.
Yeah, for sure. In terms of my background, I started off in a process improvement team in a fintech company here in Canada, Toronto. And after that, I slowly moved into IT and software development. So similar to Sarah, who started off in a different domain and moved to something else, my career path has kind of taken me towards just improving things, innovating things. And today I'm working in the central strategy team with Infotech Research Group as a central PMO office. In terms of my talk itself, I wanted to introduce the mindset of process improvement to our audience. I wanted them to understand that it is not necessarily a toolkit that you just pull out when something is wrong, but it's really an ongoing process that you think about both in the short term and long term, depending on what your final end goals need to be. And really, innovation is not something that has to be high tech and cool and have the latest technology in there, but it's really just those small stepwise improvements that you make to make your job better, to make the final product better, to make your user experience better, and can be applied to a myriad of fields. And essentially, the talk was just to introduce the thinking. How do you pilot a team that thinks about process improvement? How do we make something better for tomorrow compared to what we are at today?
That's great. You know, this kind of leads me, I'm kind of like to see what the audience who's watching thinks about this, but you mentioned like, you know, innovative companies maybe like having better technology. So I'm kind of curious if we could do a quick poll, maybe, you know, what do you think, people watching, do you feel like innovative companies have better technology? Like, yes or no, I'd be curious to see what you think there, because it kind of...
Yeah. So yes, as you said, I would be very interested to see what the audience has to say. But apart from that, in my personal experience, because of how technology has really enveloped our life in different frames and different, you know, aspects as well. Like a couple days ago, I was attending another conference and someone was telling me how their kids are so used to having Alexa at home. They might not even miss the parents, but they'll miss Alexa if she's, you know, unplugged. So it has really enveloped our life so much that people don't necessarily distinguish technology from innovation in general. So they tend to think that, oh, if someone has better technology, they're probably innovating more. But a key distinction is that if you don't even think along the lines of saying, hey, you know, I'm finding remembering my appointments very tough. I don't want to store it in my head. I actually want something that will remind me. And then you move on to a technology platform. Today, all smartphones come with a calendar and reminding application, so you can use that. But really, to even move from that thought process, and I'm guessing going forward, the next generation, because they're so used to their smartphones, won't even be in a situation whereby they'll be thinking, oh, I need to remember my appointment. And you'll be like, you remember your appointment? My phone reminds me. So they might not even be in that boat anymore. So definitely, I think the newer generation is more attuned to technology, and therefore, they might not be thinking about some of the basic problems that we might have gone through in our generation, like maybe 10 years back, but they will be innovating more than that. So yes, technology does push us forward to a certain bit, but that mindset that comes along with that, that is something that all companies have to adopt in order to be technologically advanced to begin with.
Yeah, that's so true. I just know for myself, like I was remembering the other day, like I don't actually know anyone's phone number. It just saves in my phone anymore.
Exactly.
Hey, like what my own husband's phone number is probably. great point there. So one thing I was wondering is, you know, like development oftentimes, right, is dealing with really technical setups and solutioning and what business asks us to do as developers. So what exactly as developers can we apply process improvement towards?
Yeah, a great question. I find that developers are actually in one of the most key seats to suggest process improvement to begin with. And the reason for that is they have so many tools and methodologies available in their head. They're really proficient at what they do. And therefore, they're able to say, so for example, if I know that a hammer can actually drive a nail into the wall, and I see a problem in front of me whereby a nail is actually stuck out of the wall, I will remember that, hey, there is a hammer that I can use to push this through. Meanwhile, someone who doesn't know the existence of a hammer won't even think in that direction. So I feel that as developers, you actually have the toolkit to suggest a lot of improvements that can be put into the dev environment or in the organization in general. So the first thing that often comes up in my conversation is tech debt. It's one word that everyone kind of stays away from because it's not necessarily fun. All you're doing is like, you know, it's basically the previous panelist that we were talking about. It's a lot about the maintenance side. We want to make sure that people are safe and things like that. But it's not necessarily the most fun activity. After all, you're topping up the oil or you're fixing the brakes and so on and so forth. But tech debt, when you actually think about ways to do predictive maintenance, or if you are able to detect what are some of the things that you need to continuously change or keep your eyes out for, and when you make those improvements, you can see a market improvement in the output because you have actually fixed a lot of the basic underlying issues that helps you propel yourself forward in terms of the code base, the code quality, and things like that. So that's one area. The other area that I can think of is algorithms, just simply coming together and thinking through the solution. What is that we have to do from one step to another? Referring back to some of the user personas that you might be receiving as part of requirements, or looking at some of the test cases that the QA team may have built, looking at some of your system unit tests that you may have written as well, and think about what the algorithm procedure is and what the process would be like to provide a better user experience on the whole. And it's not just the end user experience, but think about yourself as a back-end developer, as a client-side developer, as an HTML developer. What would be easy for you to maintain this code going forward? Do you actually want clunky code, or do you want something that's done neatly? So even writing the code itself is an art. You want to be minimalistic as much as possible, but achieve maximum effort. How can you think about that? Solution architecture, that's another area. You can reduce the number of calls that a system is making. How many API calls are you sending out? The time it takes for some of those response times, can you minimize that in some way? And minimizing some of the error scenarios as well. If you think about the end case, the user needs to know why something was not successful on the screen. So if we give them like an error that they can't really decipher, they're wondering, what does this error tell me? Or in some cases, people actually provide a code on the error scenario. And when the person calls the call center, they're like, oh, this is the code. Now I know what needs to be done. I can actually diagnose this. These are simple ways that you can actually improve even on the development side. A BA or a product owner or a product manager doesn't need to come up to you and say, I want a user-friendly error message. But this is something that as a developer, you can think about the end client and kind of say, okay, this person is calling the call center. They'll need some sort of context as to what happened. So helping them with the process flow. Some of the other things that generally developers work on is code refactoring. If you have written a code about 5 years ago, every language is evolving. We closed off the previous discussion talking about different languages. There's R, there's Python, Java, C, C++, so many different languages, and every language has its own pros and cons. So when you learn that, you know, in a certain language, you're able to do something, think about whether or not you can apply the same thing in your existing systems. Maybe something did it very efficiently and elegantly, and are you able to bring that over? And that's the concept of refactoring, making sure your code is updated. If there are new error scenarios that you need to reintroduce, those are some ways that you can think about. Code reviews is one of my favorite thing. It's almost like your Amazon product review or book reviews, right? So if you have done something and you want someone else's feedback on how well you've done it, you would basically take that and give it to someone else and say, hey, you know, can you take a look at my code? Can this be done in a better way? And that way we slowly improve the quality of code that we have in the system as well. And handovers, that's one of my favorite things to talk about, because often the developer would have done something, they would have submitted the code, and the QA will not even know that something was ready for them to take and start testing. So how do you improve those communication aspects and communication scenarios? Always going back to the requirements and understanding whether or not you are coding for the right thing. Are you building the right solution? Being more attuned and connected to your end users is very important in that case. And that will automatically help you improve a lot of things, because at the end of the day, you're trying to make their day better. And last but not the least, having explicit ownership for things is very important. Sometimes what we do is, hey, you know, I'm doing this code, but this is not really my area of responsibility to make sure that the code quality is done well. All I'm responsible for is a chunk of code that I've submitted, and therefore I'm not going to look at anything else. But instead, if we promote that concept of, hey, you know, I will take this up because this is, you know, I'm interested in this, it helps with your career progression. It helps with your leadership skills. It helps with, you know, gaining more perspective of the high level view of how the code is set up, how it should be improved, and so on and so forth. So that would be my, you know, those would be some of my suggestions as to where you can start looking at process improvement.
Yeah, that's great. You know what? I really liked your earlier point about developers kind of being, you know, uniquely positioned to help with these process improvement teams, because we really do, developers tend to have that debugging, that troubleshooting
yes.
mindset, and that's what you need, right? To really,
yes.
you need that mindset in a process improvement team to really figure
yes.
out the best solution. So that's,
yes,
that's really
exactly.
great story. Yeah.
Wonderful.
And then technical debt too. I mean, we all face that. So kind of speaking of that and along these lines, you know, so we can't talk about process improvement without talking about documentation, right? So that's a big part of it. So what would you say to those watching that maybe they don't feel like they have time for this extensive documentation? What can they do about that?
Yeah, I come from a BA background in the sense I love writing documentation. And if you go to my LinkedIn profile, I've written a lot of blog posts as well. And that's simply because I enjoy sharing and I enjoy writing. And I'm totally acknowledging the fact that not everyone is going to be in the same boat. And they might be like, hey, I'm the person that uses contractions in chat. And if I cannot talk and I can just record my message, I'm going to go for that. So yes, documentation is something that people are not necessarily interested in, not everybody. But what I really mean here during my talk when I was talking about documentation is specifically focusing on what you need to write down and what is it that you need to communicate. It doesn't need to be very different from your verbal communication. Like if you're talking to your boss, you're not going to give them like a 20-page essay of, you know, this is how this button works. But it's really highlighting specific pieces and saying that, you know, these are the aspects that we need to focus on and these are the things that we need to look at. So really focusing on understanding why is it that you're documenting something. So it doesn't need to be very extensive. And especially if you think about the agile environment, you're really looking at specific formats. As a user, I want to, so that, you know, a simple context that gives you the business case behind it, what you're trying to achieve. And then if you need more details in terms of functional requirements, personally, I usually start off with the epic, the user story, and then I go into some functional requirements. And then at the end of it, I make sure that my acceptance criteria kind of covers everything off. So it's really to initiate the thought process behind it rather than writing something down for the sake of writing it. It's not to create more red tape. The other thing that I recommend when we are writing documentation is capturing some of the key decisions. And the reason I say that is we're moving into a product management type of world whereby everyone wants to understand the whole concept of why we are building something. What is the value behind building something? And when you're thinking about the value, you cannot shy away from the why aspect of it, the pain point, as you mentioned, the debugging. You know exactly where things are going wrong. What is the pain that we're trying to solve? And key decisions often tend to be lumped along with those pain points because you might be like, oh, you know, I've got 5 different pain points here, but I'm not going to be working on 3 of them. Why? Why am I not working on those? Why is this not part of my MVP? Versus these other two items, I am going to be working on them because they seem to be the biggest pain points, and this is the reason why. If you get some sort of executive decisioning behind it, if you get some sort of feedback in terms of saying this is key because this kind of maps to our company's mission and vision, this is mapping onto our key metrics, this is going to impact our bottom line, those kind of aspects are very important in capturing the key decisions. And the reason I say that is because, you know, we will be evolving over a period of time. Nothing is going to be consistent. Even with process improvement teams, there are short-term goals and there are long-term goals. And maybe in the long term, we realize that the why that we initially started off with doesn't hold true anymore. For example, back in the day, people used to think, oh, you know, after every update that I do to a specific code, I need to write out my name to say that I was the one who did this. But today, when we're talking about user provisioning, user IDs, and using the whole concept of Azure and making sure that people are all set up in the system is automatically able to pull the person who made that change. So in effect, if your process still says you need to sign the document at the end, it doesn't make a lot of sense because now the system can pull it up. So understanding the why behind these key decisions. And then last but not the least, understanding some standardized documentation as well. I am a big fan of living documents, and the reason for that is it helps with onboarding. It helps with some of the standardized structures. If you're looking to get some sort of certification, like with ISO or CMMI, it really helps with that. Last but not the least, it really puts the power onto the hands of people who need to start using it and implementing it. So, for example, often a lot of times what happens is the business might come back to you and say, hey, you know, for error 101, the error message today doesn't make a lot of sense. Can you change it to something that's a bit more business friendly? Being in Canada, we also need to support English and French across all provinces because we've got two official languages. So when you think about something like that, or even Microsoft that kind of works across so many different countries in the world, and every part of the world has their own restrictions on languages, think about making the error messages content managed. Again, this is part of the documentation, but simply by pushing that part of empowerment to the business owners or the product owners or the people, the linguistics department that's actually doing the translation, you remove a whole layer of, you know, responsibility from yourself. You're not going in to make these tiny things. And now your development team is actually empowered to make more innovative changes in the system rather than going in and fixing an apostrophe or adding in an extra the in the sentence or whatever that is, right? So thinking about documentation that way, in the sense that I will do what I need to do, but anything outside of that, let me empower the people who need access to it. And then therefore I remove myself, free up myself to do something better.
That's great. So I'm admittedly one of those people that kind of, I dread documentation and having to do that. So it's kind of good to hear and know that it doesn't necessarily have to be like a big thesis level, you know, documentation. We could keep it kind of high level executive summary, focus on the pain points and all of that. It doesn't have to be too daunting and overwhelming. So that's good to hear. So we talked a lot about, you know, process improvement, how we can do that. Now let's focus on what are some tools really that we can use to help us with our process improvement.
Yeah, for sure. So there are lots of process automation tools that are out there in the market. So if we do a simple Google search looking for RPA tools, these are going to come up. In fact, one of the tools that I recently discovered was part of Microsoft Power Automate, which was called Process Advisor. And often what happens is when we're looking at digitizing these processes, we need to sit and kind of job shadow every person who's doing the task, ask them to grab screenshots, put them in a document, maybe sit there and time them to find out how long does this take for them, and multiply that by maybe 1,000 applicants or maybe the number of, you know, tasks that they're doing or how many times they're doing the same thing. And then based on that, we even start looking into some of the automation. Like in the previous panel talk, we were talking about automation using data. How do we build these models and how does it automatically build some of these things? One thing I do want to caution the audience about is that when you're trying to automate something, always try to implement that manually first, because you need to really understand what are the exception flows, what are the alternate flows. Are we able to handle it in a manual way first? Maybe test that out. Like I said in my talk as well, piloting is one of my favorite things to do because it really helps you identify all those little changes you need to think about, all the things that you didn't necessarily think about on paper, but in real life, they do happen. So think about manually doing a specific process and then try to digitize that to see how technology can assist you as a tool base. That is not the main, like every technology is not going to solve all the problems out there in the world. If that was so, we wouldn't be having a lot of pain points, but technology is a tool for you to enhance what you're trying to do. So once you have done things manually, you can look at some of these RPA tools as well. And like I said, with this process advisor, what that does is pretty cool, that you would go into the screen that you're trying to work on, you click on the specific steps that you go through, and it provides you with, you know, a walkthrough of all the steps that you actually did, the UI pieces that you clicked on the screen. And then you can use that, and it tracks the time as well. And then you can take that and kind of do an analysis of how long it actually takes you. And if you multiply that by, you know, 10,000 times, that's the number of applications you get. It's really easy for you to analyze how quickly these things can add up. And the benefit of automation, therefore, right? So when you're doing these process improvement activities, when you're trying to innovate something, you track the time that it actually takes for you. And then you see whether or not there is an ROI. Is there a return on this investment? If I automate this process, in fact, I'm trying to do something right now at my workplace, trying to automate something. And I know that every month I take about an hour, 2 hours to get the things together. So for me, if I know I'm doing the exact same step every month, why not automate it? And I will save 2 hours and I can put that towards something else. And even, you know, transferring the ownership of this process is going to be easy for me because I just have to tell them, hey, click on this button and everything will be done for you. So you don't need to worry about it. I've assigned an owner, but they don't have to go through the painful process of going through it. So yes, then one of the resources that I provided, one of the links there is softwarereviews.com. It provides a list of all the different kinds of automation tools to your question. And you know, you can use those tools to monitor and assess whether or not it's a good fit for you and understand the why behind you're trying to do something like that. Is it because you're repeating the process? Is it because it's something that you can track online already, like submission of forms instead of using an email, you know, creating a new line in some sort of file, which again can be done by Microsoft Power Automate. So thinking about the why will help you quite a bit in terms of shortlisting the tool that you want to use for that specific purpose as well.
Yeah, that's great. I love that you said, you know, first of all, to do it manually first before you start trying to automate or use any of those tools. But I especially love that you did mention Process Advisor. You know, being in the Power Platform space myself, when it was just released in general availability just a month or so ago, and I had to get my hands on it as soon as I saw it because I think it's so huge for helping us with our process improvement techniques and being able to really see what our process is and analyze that deeply so that we can figure out the best way to improve that and use it along with the RPA functionality with Power Automate desktop flows and all of that. So super powerful, definitely a good tool to have in your tool belt there for your process improvement scenarios. So. Well, all of this has been so great. And, you know, I really think sometimes the hardest part of anything is just figuring out how to get started, right? So beyond some of the tools that you just mentioned and all the great advice you've given so far, are there any additional, you know, links or things that you would suggest for people that are want to get started with this?
For sure, yeah. In the resources that I shared, one of the things that I personally like is getting a quick intro about Lean Six Sigma. It is a toolkit. It changes the way you're thinking about certain things. It really drives you towards that whole concept of what is the value behind something. And I think in our audience, I'm assuming there are going to be a lot of newbies as well who are coming into the development space. They've done a lot in school and they're really excited to apply all those skills in the practical world. And yes, I've done that transition as well. Like in school, everything seems perfect. Data sets seem to be perfect. Environments don't have any errors because we are working in a very controlled environment. But real life is not like that, right? So as you're going through some of these resources, you have to think about how do you want to improve and apply these things in the real world. You want to think about what are some of the barriers that you will have to cross that wasn't necessarily covered as part of your course material. So to give you an example, you know, how do you account for human error? What do you do when someone is willfully maybe entering the wrong information in the system or someone who is willfully bypassing a certain process because they feel that this is too much of a red tape that they don't want to deal with? And because of that, what happens in the process? How does it break down? And you really want to think about the human aspect that often we don't necessarily get a lot of exposure to in you know, pure engineering courses. At least I felt that way because a lot of times we were talking about voice of customer, but our test subjects were often just our own classmates who didn't really want to jeopardize our project, right? So they always give positive responses to our work as well. So it's really hard for you to apply that in a practical world. And you have to think about the different human elements in there. So Lean Six Sigma really gives you a lot of aspects in the toolkit about how do you probe the user to find out what the underlying cause is. For example, the fishbone diagram, the quality functional diagram, which is basically identifying what are the different aspects of quality are you measuring a specific product against? And what is the weightage that the audience actually puts against these items? And therefore, what are the specific product features that you need to focus on? In fact, I find that a lot of aspects in Six Sigma, I was able to translate that over to the product management side as well, because it gave me a new way of thinking. I came with the background of understanding What is it that my customer wants? And I think that's the main pivot that a lot of new folks in the industry need to think about, is it's not just about the coding aspect, which is a lot of fun because you're building solutions and you're learning all these new techniques, but you need to understand why you're doing something like that. And Six Sigma really helps you with that sort of thinking. The other thing that I want to highlight in the resources section is a diagram which is called the Process Improvement Framework. And that gives you three different aspects. One is for software development in general, any process improvement framework, and process improvement framework specifically for software development. So that kind of goes back to a lot of the concepts that I had mentioned earlier about CMMI, Scrum, Six Sigma. Again, to your point earlier, April, it's going to be very documentation heavy because everyone has just sort of, it's been tried and tested in so many different environments that they want to give you the best information possible. But then as you're reading through some of this material, you know, mark and bookmark those locations that you think are really relevant to what you're doing. And the ones that are not, put it on the parking lot or something like that, and then revisit to see if your department has actually evolved. You don't need to start with the entire toolkit the first day, but taking it bit by bit would take you much, much longer and farther in the process.
That's great. I think that's, you know, that's great advice for not just process improvement, but really anything you're doing. Start with why, focus on the why first, and then the rest will come. So yeah, thank you so much, Manu. This has been great. And everyone, be sure to check out the chat for all those resources that she did just mention so that you can check those out.
Thank you so much for having me, April.
Thank you.